This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. Today we'll begin our show with a conversation with Professor James Grijalva. He's the director of the Tribal Environmental Law Project for the Northern Plains Indian Law Center at the University of North Dakota. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Your law school will be hosting a national Indian law competition on Friday and Saturday. What can you tell us about it?
Well, we're real excited about it, Doug. The Native American Law Students Association is a national organization of law students, both native and non-native, who are interested in the complex areas that federal Indian law presents. And many of these students hope to practice in the area, maybe representing tribes or working for state agencies or working for the federal government. And just like any student organization that a law school or university has, this gives the opportunity for students of like interest to collect together, to explore issues, to have events, to try to educate others in the student body about the issues that interest them. And so the Native American Law Students Association, or what we sometimes refer to it by its acronym as NALSA, it's a national organization, but like national organizations, they have local chapters. So at the University of North Dakota School of Law, we have a chapter of NALSA. It's the UND chapter. I'm the faculty advisor to that group. And I've got a group of students every year that are interested in these issues and participate in all kinds of activities. One of the activities that is most looked forward to every year is a moot court competition. That's M-O-O-T. It's a little play on the fact that it's not a real legal case. It's based on a fictional case that somebody's written, but it presents various Indian law issues, typically in front of the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court. So you have two sides, and what happens is teams of two students act as the attorneys for one side. They write a brief just like real attorneys would in a real case. They submit that brief in advance of the competition. It gets graded by some attorneys who volunteer to do that. And then the students go to the competition and they sit before three attorneys who act as Supreme Court justices and ask them questions, sometimes very challenging questions, while the students make oral arguments about their case. Unlike the real world, where you really represent one client and you're always on that side, because this is an educational experience, the students write a brief on one side as the attorney for one party. Then when they come to the competition, they get to argue once on their side. Then they have to flip in the next round, argue the other side.
Wow.
So the students really get a chance to see how difficult it is when you're working for one side to anticipate the arguments of the other side. And they're forced to have to look at the weaknesses of their own case by arguing on the other side. And of course, they get judged by those attorneys. They get scored. And based on their scores on the brief and on their oral arguments, of course, they proceed to the final rounds and ultimately to the championship round at the end of the competition.
That reminds us that court cases are debate with consequences.
There you go. There you go.
How many students do you expect for this competition?
We're looking at roughly 80 to 90 student participants. This competition is sort of unique. There are law schools that host a competition every year, same competition every year, and people go to that law school for that competition. The NALSA competition rotates among schools because the national organization wants to include as many schools as possible. And so this is not a competition that's hosted at UND every year. We had to put in a bid for that. And we were selected by the national organization to host it this year. Of course, we got the bid last year before the pandemic hit. So unfortunately, instead of having 80 participants and 25 coaches come with them to Grand Forks, North Dakota, we are going to be on Zoom like everybody is. But we're trying to make the best of it, and we think that we can do that. So the competition is going to be hosted at UND for the first time ever. This is actually the first time the University of North Dakota School of Law has ever hosted a national competition. So we're very proud of that. We're excited that it happens to be this competition. And we're looking forward to those students and their coaches zooming in. We also have, Doug, just the, you know, the silver lining of the COVID slash Zoom world is that now we can have attorneys volunteer to be judges who aren't just from Grand Forks and Fargo, but are from all across the country. So we're going to have actually more Indian law attorneys and actually some real federal, state, and tribal judges who are going to Zoom in to be judges for the students. So we think the educational experience is going to be quite unique and quite exciting for the students.
Is Indian law a growth area?
It is, because so many more tribes are participating in the national economy, are participating in the regional economy, are exercising their sovereignty as governments to provide, you know, housing and education and health services for their tribal citizens. And they've got to work with state agencies, state governments, federal government, federal agencies. And frankly, in order to do that effectively, you've got to have lawyers that know those areas. And so, as I said at the outset, Doug, you know, some of my students graduate and they go work for the state of North Dakota as a state attorney that has experience and knowledge about Indian law and Indian country. Some of my students, of course, go to tribes, sometimes their own tribe, to represent their tribe in those same kinds of circumstances. And some go to federal agencies for the same reasons. So there is, as well as I should say, there are private law firms out there who target tribes and tribal businesses to represent them, because those attorneys understand and know Indian law. It's not common across the country to find law firms that actually have expertise in that area. And frankly, before I came to North Dakota, I practiced environmental law in a Seattle private law firm that represented a whole host of industry players in the environmental realm. But we also represented Indian tribes who were doing natural resource development and needed advice on environmental law. And we also represented some tribes that were trying to develop their environmental program capacity to regulate activities that were occurring on their reservations to make sure they protected the health and welfare of their tribal citizens.
Jim Grijalva is a professor in the UND Law School and director of the Tribal Environmental Law Project. Jim, what brought you to this specialty?
Well, it's a long story, Doug. My dad was an Indian Health Service dentist. And so as a child, I grew up moving from reservation to reservation as he was reassigned everywhere from South Dakota to New Mexico to Alaska. I didn't know it then, but I was developing this sort of social justice concern about some of the disparities I saw in Indian country, economic disparities among others. And as I got older and I became more and more interested in the outdoors and the natural environment, I decided I wanted to be an environmental lawyer. And I started working with a law firm where the environmental practice group was chaired by a man who had been a Bureau of Indian Affairs attorney at the start of environmental law in the 70s. And so he had a real interest in this, and he started reaching out to tribes, and he had a cohort of clients who were industrial clients who needed help negotiating environmental law. But he also had several tribal clients that were interested in the same thing. And when we first met and I told him my story about how I'd grown up as an Indian Health Service dentist's son, he asked if I was interested in doing work like that. And I said, absolutely. And suddenly we started to build kind of a sub practice where we represented tribes doing environmental work, and we built a pretty thriving practice. So when I came to North Dakota, I will tell you, Doug, I came specifically because I wanted a state school that cared about their students and valued good teaching. But I also wanted a state school that was interested in service, and particularly Indian country service. My stepmother is a Mohawk Indian physician who knew the InMed program at UND and gave it very high marks. So when I was interviewed and gave an opportunity to join the faculty here, I jumped at it because I saw the possibility that I could really recognize my two passions, teaching and service to Indian country.
How would you describe the mission of the Indian Law Center?
Well, you know, it's also related to the story, Doug, that it just so happened that when I came in 1994, the law school had just developed the Indian Law Center. And the mission, as it was initially envisioned, was both a service mission to assist Indian communities in addressing their legal needs, in the broadest sense that you can think of, and also in providing scholarly analysis of the complex issues that federal Indian law presents. As you know from all kinds of stories, the complex interactions between tribes and the federal government and the federal agencies, tribes in the state and the state agencies, create this wealth of interesting scenarios and issues that really require some diligent and dedicated study. This is not just a topic you pick up in a book and practice one case or do one transaction and call it good. You really can't be effective without some serious knowledge. So when I came, the Indian Center, was primarily focused on providing service to tribes in helping them develop their tribal court systems. So tribes, of course, preceded the United States of America and had their own systems of justice in the way of dealing with consequences where people didn't follow the rules or setting out the rules that were expected to be followed. Unfortunately, the Western contact tended to dismantle those traditional justice forms, and they were replaced after a period of years with more Western-style looking courts. Well, tribes needed help to develop their court systems to make them work effectively. And our Tribal Judicial Institute, which is one component of the Northern Plains Indian Law Center, began to get federal grants to assist tribes in developing that capacity. So in the last two decades or so, the Tribal Judicial Institute has worked with literally 250 tribes all across the country, helping them to develop and enhance their court systems. And that has been our main service goal and our main service activity at the Indian Law Center, which I'm very proud about, because we've had a reach that extends beyond the region. Although we are involved in every tribal court system in the region and have a significant influence, as well as the fact that many of the tribal courts and the tribal attorneys general's office include graduates now of the University of North Dakota School of Law.
Well, the School of Law, again, is having this National Indian Law Competition Friday and Saturday. And the Friday event will also feature a tribal flag ceremony. The five American Indian tribes in our state will present their national flags to the law school for permanent display. Does the center have formal agreements with the tribes in North Dakota?
Not formal agreements in the sense that, you know, we have contracts for providing service, but we have a long history of mutual respect. I think the tribes understand that part of what our goal is at the law school is to provide service to the tribes. And that goes, of course, beyond educating some of the tribal citizens who then go back to become attorneys for the tribe. But also, as I said, with the Tribal Judicial Institute, to provide service in the way of helping tribes exercise their sovereignty, you know, beyond just the concept of the tribes interacting outside their reservation with states and the federal government. Inside the reservation, of course, just like in the state of North Dakota, there are contract issues, there are family law issues, there are kinds of things that happen in tribal court that are just like the kinds of things that happen in a state court every day in North Dakota and across the country. And so our assistance has really helped to cement the relationship informally rather than formally that led to, I think, the confidence that the tribes had that when we reached out, and when I say we, I mean the Native American Law Students Association really had the idea about 2 years ago. My students pushed for, we want the flags to be displayed. We have a ceremonial courtroom in the law school. It has been renamed just recently, the Gerald Vandewall Courtroom, in honor and respect for the former Chief Justice of the North Dakota Supreme Court, who is one of the longest Supreme Court justices, state Supreme Court justices in the country. We have great respect for Jerry Vandewall. He's done so much for relations with the Indian tribes and also for support of the law school. So we renamed the courtroom, which is a beautiful space in the law school, after Jerry Vandewall. And the students recognize that as a state courtroom, there is the United States flag and there is the state of North Dakota flag. But the five tribes flags aren't there. They're not represented. And they are, of course, governments that have sovereignty and exercise sovereignty over their territory and their citizens within the state. So the student said, couldn't we reach out to the tribes and see if we could get the flags? The students went to the dean and to the faculty of the Indian Law Center, proposed this idea. They got the support that they deserve for this great idea. And we reached out to the tribes, and all five tribes have agreed to send us their flags, including representatives to post those flags in an official ceremony that's going to happen Friday evening. We're actually live streaming that event. It'll be a 40-minute ceremony, but we're going to try to observe tribal cultural protocols to make sure this is a solemn event that comes off in the most respectful way possible. And we're really pleased that the tribes have entrusted us with the flags, which, as you said, will be on permanent display in the courtroom, in the Vandewalle courtroom, along with the United States and North Dakota state flag.
Jim Grijalva is director of the Tribal Environmental Law Project at UND. Jim, how would you describe the environmental law issues that face tribes? What takes up most of the space there?
Well, that's a hard question, Doug, because it really depends on where you are. The variety of environmental law issues are like the variety that any particular state deals with. I will say that unlike most states, you know, North Dakota has been regulating its environment for, 150 years and most aggressively since the 1970s when the federal government created the modern federal environmental law realm. Tribes haven't had that opportunity until some years later. In the late 80s, early 90s, Congress amended several environmental laws to allow tribes to run their own programs. And I think maybe one of the most pressing issues is not nearly as exciting to the general audience, but it's just literally building the capacity to run tribal environmental programs to make sure that in federal environmental laws, which were premised on a partnership between the federal EPA and states, actually effectively run inside Indian country. States generally don't have authority in Indian country like they do in other places within the state. And so if we're going to have national protection across the country, we need a functioning program inside Indian country. EPA steps in occasionally to take care of, say, issuing a permit or cleaning up a polluted site or a spill. But generally, there's not a lot going on in Indian country in terms of actual functioning programs. So I'd say the answer to your question, Doug, first off, is we need more effective programs in Indian country, and that requires tribes to build the governmental capacity to do that. After that, I'd say water pollution and concerns about preserving water quality are probably preeminent because every tribe has water, and all tribes understand that clean water is critical to the uses that you'd want to make of your waters. And after that, some tribes have air pollution issues. Some tribes have landfill or land-related issues. And then there's, a litany of other environmental issues that some tribes are concerned about, but others are not.
Could the Environmental Law Project improve the relationships between tribes and governments and the industries that surround their lands?
Well, it certainly has the possibility of doing so, Doug. And there have been situations where we have helped tribes to initiate conversations with states and industry. We don't represent tribes as lawyers, so we're not like a clinic where the tribe comes to us to be its lawyer. We're more of an information source, and so we can help tribes understand what the legal and framework is that they operate within. But I will tell you, one of the first projects I worked on was with the Spirit Lake Nation. When I first came to North Dakota, the Assistant Attorney General for North Dakota, who worked on environmental affairs, was interested in doing some sort of memorandum of agreement where if the tribe needed assistance, particularly with an environmental accident or catastrophe, that the state said it would be willing to assist if the tribe needed that assistance. And so I was actually involved in negotiations between the tribe and the state in that realm. And I had done that actually with tribes and counties in the state of Washington when I was an attorney there before I came to North Dakota. I certainly think that having formalized relationships between tribes and states and their state subdivisions can be very effective, particularly when there is an emergency that requires fast action. But even over the long run, it makes sense. Good, you know, good neighbors understand that pollution sometimes crosses boundaries, right? The pollution goes down the river and crosses into the tribal jurisdiction or into the state jurisdiction. Air pollution moves with the wind. And so it makes sense for us to cooperate as effectively as we can.
James Grijalva is a professor at the UND School of Law. He's the director of the Tribal Environmental Law Project for the Northern Plains Indian Law Center. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure, Doug. Thanks for speaking with me.
Next on Main Street, a commentary from Indian Country Today editor Mark Trahant.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with over 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
I'm Dave Thompson. This week's Legislative Review guest will be Republican Senator Brad Beckedahl of Williston. We'll talk about what's been accomplished thus far, what the main issues and sticking points will be after crossover, and about bills specifically from northwestern North Dakota and the oil patch. Legislative Review airs at 6:30 p.m. Central Time on our radio service and anytime on our digital platforms.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tribes are watching closely as Deb Haaland, the first Native American to be nominated for a cabinet position, faces her confirmation hearing as Interior Secretary. Today, Mark Trahant's commentary is about the nominee who deeply understands tribal issues and is ready to act accordingly, but first has to get past the Senate.
She's the first Native American to ever go through a confirmation hearing for a cabinet post. And if she's confirmed by the Senate, she will be the first ever tribal citizen to run a major agency, the Interior Department. There is a lot of history unfolding. Representative Haaland stood with the water protectors at Standing Rock. She has stood with those opposed to oil and gas development in her home state, New Mexico. And she once was a government witness in a hearing about sacred lands on the U.S. border. And at that event, she told the Trump administration and the U.S. Border Patrol, "I don't know how you can sleep at night." Haaland is a citizen of Laguna Pueblo. She is 60 years old, and her job would be extraordinary. The Interior Department has a remarkable mission, managing the relationship with tribal governments, administering mineral rights, national parks, wildlife and endangered species, and approving oil and gas drilling and mining. And that is the issue that is bringing out the opposition. Republicans generally favor oil and gas development on federal lands. The Biden administration has said climate change, not energy independence, will be its touchstone. A lot of eyes will be watching Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia. He's chairman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee and a longtime supporter of the oil and gas industry. After a vote earlier this month, he reaffirmed that support. He said, "My position on the oil and gas industry has not changed. I have always been and will always be an outspoken advocate for an all-of-the-above energy policy that includes fracking and responsible energy infrastructure development like the Keystone XL pipeline." One early opponent is Montana Senator Steve Daines. The Republican has said Haaland's positions are radical, citing the Green New Deal and her opposition to fracking. He recently tweeted that Representative Haaland's nomination is extremely alarming. Representative Haaland has called for the elimination of oil, natural gas, and coal. America cannot afford this radical transition away from reliable energy. Daines said he will use procedural powers to slow or block her nomination. Still, if Chairman Manchin and all of the Democrats vote together, Haaland will be confirmed. The Haaland nomination is also a key indicator about the role of tribal nations in the Biden administration, and tribes have high hopes. There are so many issues that have never received full attention from the federal government, ranging from the co-management of public lands and wildlife to the actual return of lands taken illegally. Tribes will be expecting a lot more than just window decoration, pushing for a secretary who understands tribal issues and is ready to act accordingly. But first, she has to get past the Senate. I'm Mark Trahant.
Mark Trahant is the editor of the online news service Indian Country Today. Coming up on Main Street, a discussion about North Dakota writers. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The House has passed a bill that would prevent local law enforcement from providing assistance to federal agents who are enforcing federal firearm laws. Its supporters say House Bill 1383 is designed to uphold Second Amendment rights. The main sponsor, Bismarck Republican Representative Rick Becker, told the House there is legislation making its way in Congress to severely restrict the rights of gun owners.
This is an all-or-nothing kind of bill because we know what's coming before us. There's no middle ground whatsoever. We either are going to actively do what we can to preserve the Second Amendment for our citizens in North Dakota, or we aren't.
But Rolla Democratic Representative Marvin Nelson says he doubts that federal legislation stands much of a chance.
Frankly, we have a better chance of getting a manned spacecraft landing on Mars this year than that bill passing Congress. That's a boogeyman. That's not going to happen.
The bill passed 59-34. It now goes to the Senate. The House has passed a bill to give it more say in what happens after the state health officer and governor declares an emergency. The measure says the health officer's emergency declaration would last for 30 days, and it can be extended another 30 days by legislative action. It adds the majority leaders of the House and Senate, or their designees, to a Department of Emergency Services Advisory Committee. West Fargo Republican Representative Ben Koppelman.
If the governor deems the emergency conditions will likely exist beyond 60 days, he shall call a special session to have the legislature take action to address the extended disaster or emergency. This section allows the legislature to meet remotely to address such emergencies if approved by legislative management.
Koppelman said the terms of an order or declaration issued by a city or county may not be more restrictive than the state unless set out in state law. And he said it requires the governor to work with the legislature if the order seeks to impose restrictions on the public. No one spoke against the measure on the House floor if passed. It passed 75-19, and now House Bill 1495 will go to the Senate for further work. And the House has changed its mind and passed the budget for the State Ethics Commission. That commission was the result of a public vote that put the commission in the state's constitution. The House rejected the commission's budget on Monday, and the bill went back to the House Appropriations Committee. It came back to the House today at the same budget level. Grand Forks Democratic Representative Corey Mock asked the House to pass the budget.
Regardless of what any member feels about the commission, including how it was created, why it exists, or even any perceived needs of an ethics commission, this is an important budget that we need to move forward so that we can continue working and developing this commission properly.
The budget for the agency is just under $500,000. It passed 61-33 and will now go to the Senate for further work. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and joining us now is Sue Skaliski. She's a program coordinator for Humanities North Dakota, and we're going to talk about lots of books, reading and writing, and stuff that's going on at Humanities ND. Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for Doug. I always love being on Main Street.
Well, we can tell everybody they can find out more at humanitiesnd.org. But when I went up there, I found out about the Little Mo Writers Incubator Project. Tell us about this.
Yeah, we are so excited about this project. They are coming to an end this May, but this is a cohort of 8 writers that were selected through an application process at the end of last summer. So it is a 9-month low residency writing program for people who are working on a book project or another similar nonfiction project with an end publication result. And so we had our, like I said, the first cohort is right in the middle of their year and doing really well. We're going to offer it again next year. We have 2 instructors for that incubator, Deb Marcourt. She is actually Iowa's poet laureate and a professor at Iowa University, and Teo Besquet. He is a professor at Bismarck State College, and together they are dynamic teachers and mentors.
Well, we've had Deborah on our show a couple of times, actually. She's a pretty well-known writer and in her own right. So what was her role here? How were these 8 writers incubated?
Well, the application process required a lengthy manuscript submission. And so right off the bat, they could see where each of these writers are at. And the whole idea behind it is to work with them in that small group where there is individual time as well on that manuscript and the growth of that and the improvement of their writing and the looking forward ahead to publication and what all that entails. So really it is a growing opportunity with two professional writers and mentors to take them step by step through the process.
Now, are they involved in this upcoming Page Turner event?
Yes. So we had our first Page Turner event last November, and we featured 8 North Dakota writers who had recently published a book and decided this time we were going to feature the Lil Mo writers where they are at in their work that they've been working on all year. I'm so excited for this event. Deb and Teo will start the event off with an introduction and what they've been working on with this cohort. And then they're going to turn it over to them where each person will be able to read an excerpt from their work and introduce the next person. So Page Turner is a showcase of writing. This particular event is not interactive. So it is simply sit back and enjoy the writing that these people have been working so hard on.
And you can sign up at humanitiesnd.org. It's free to the public, but you want to, you know, register for it. It's March 7th, and it runs from 4 to 5:30 Central Time. Do you expect a number of published books as a result of this Little Mo Writers Incubator Project?
Oh, absolutely. That's the goal. Yep. You know, we offer writing programs. We've had them in the past. We'll have them again in the future. We have a couple going on right now. And that is really the goal, is to get these writers who have big ideas and talent, but just don't know how to do it. So, yes, I believe books will come out of this.
Is this incubator project unique?
You know, it's unique to North Dakota. So prior to this first cohort, there isn't a low residency writing program in our state. There wasn't until now. I think the closest being the Twin Cities and Billings, Montana. So it is great for the state of North Dakota. We want to keep it going strong. We're looking at having two cohorts this coming year.
Well, this reading and writing project by Humanities ND is also sponsored in part by Prairie Public. I'll just get that out there.
So yes,
we're
yes.
proud of that connection. Also coming up, One Book, One North Dakota. And this is going to feature Deb Marquardt again, right?
It is. It's kind of Deb Marquardt month at Humanities North Dakota. So we have Deb this Sunday talking a little bit about her memoir, The Horizontal Life, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. I think a lot of us can relate to that. But she has a new book that's going to be published here very shortly. So she will be reading from that new book.
And that is, as you mentioned, February 28th, and again from 4 to 5:30 Central Time. Go to humanitiesnd.org and register.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about Read ND, Read North Dakota.
All right. So Read North Dakota, I think, is a treasure that we've had for quite a long time. You can connect to it off of our website, and the top menu, you hit library. And that library tab will open up. You can go right to Read ND. And Read ND is, we have curated North Dakota authors and their works going way back. It's a work in progress. Right there on the homepage, if you go to it, you can read a great story about Kevin Carvel.
Yes.
Who lives in Mott. Love him. His ever-growing library is something that we should all visit. He's very welcoming and loves people to come in and tour it, but that's what that site is, which is just an ongoing, the big stack of books there out on the internet. And we love when people let us know and fill us in on new authors that we can feature up there.
Sue Skaliski is Program Coordinator for Humanities ND. You mentioned Read ND, which is readnd.org. It's another website that you can find this link to Kevin Carvel's story. Kevin's very well known to lots of people. Used to be a forum reporter, worked for Byron Dorgan for years. He's been around the state and is a lover of the state's books, actually, unlike yes. just about anyone else. I think his library has 13,000 books in it.
It does, and it just keeps growing.
It's a special place in Mott, North Dakota, Kevin Carvel's library. The quarterly magazine put out by Humanities North Dakota, what's in the next issue?
You know, our next issue will be coming out April 1st. Now, this is a members-only magazine. So I know in the past we've sent it out to a lot of people. We are now making it a members-only magazine. This is our Sense of Place issue coming up April 1st. So we had numerous submissions from people all over North Dakota writing about their sense of place here in our state. And some people that came to us as poetry. Others were scholarly articles, some fiction, some memoir, and some art. And so it's going to be a dynamic magazine. If you're interested in getting that magazine, we are a membership-based organization. We offer a lot of free events, but our members have benefits. So again, go to humanitiesnd.org and check out what it takes to become a member.
Well, besides Humanities North Dakota Magazine, what other benefits are there, and what is the cost to be a member?
All right. Well, lots of benefits. We have a section on our website called The Vault. The Vault is for members only, and in there we house all the recordings of our events. So most of our events virtually are free, and if you catch the live event, that's awesome. But if your schedule that day just doesn't allow that to happen, our members can go into that vault, and at any time for a lifetime, they can watch that recording. So if there are events they're interested in, they can go ahead and register and watch it on their own time. That's a huge, huge benefit. We also have the magazine. We have the electronic versions of all past magazines in that vault that they can thumb through on a reader right there. We do have occasional members-only events. So I know coming up this fall, our Game Changer Ideas Festival will be a virtual series again, due to COVID. But we are, one of our speakers is going to be a members only event. And so we just try to do things throughout the year to give them that added treatment, that added thankfulness. So what does it cost to become a member? It's simply a minimum donation of $50 a year. The other benefit is any of our classes, which do cost money, are free to members. Always.
Okay, so that's a latte a month.
Absolutely.
You know, we're a member organization as well. We've got lots of people who listen who aren't members, and I know that Humanities North Dakota probably has lots of people who go to the website who aren't members, but members help make it possible. We just need to remind people of that occasionally.
Absolutely. Yep.
Now, you're a writer, aren't you, Sue?
I am. I've been a journalist for 30 plus years. I for a stint of 12 years, I taught high school journalism. And about 4 years ago, I quit teaching so I could publish my first book. And I did that. That was a memoir I published in 2018. And then I published my first ever fiction thriller in 2019. I'm currently working on another fiction thriller with the same main character as my first book.
So when you approach a writing project, what's your process?
Oh, wow. It's a process. I'll tell you right now, as I'm involved in a writing group here in Bismarck. I taught a memoir writing class 2 years ago at BSC, and we, about six of us, formed a group and have been meeting ever since. Lots of books have come out of that, and you may have heard of Tyler Ock. His book Broken Gifts came out, oh gosh, was it November of last year? Tyler is a recovering addict and 10 years sober this January, and he has a dynamic story to tell. His book is worth looking up. His book is also on Read North Dakota, the readnd.org site.
It's a reminder, I think, that writing is a very personal job. You know, you approach it from your point of view, and maybe other people read it. But I can tell you that my father wrote stuff decades ago that I treasure now, because it's sort of a look inside, you know, his head. It's worthwhile.
Oh, it's a gift. It's a legacy. And I love memoirs. And, you know, we're going to be offering another memoir writing class in the future. It's worth taking. That's what I would tell my classes, that it's worth writing it down for those you love.
Yeah.
So when you're gone, they've got your take on life. So it's great. But you're right. Writers, our process is all different. For me, I'm taking a writing class right now online. I have my writing group. It takes time. And it's fun. That's what I'll say about that.
There's lots of stuff coming up. Deb Marquardt this Sunday with One Book, One North Dakota, talking about the horizontal world, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. That's her latest book, a memoir. Then you've got that March 7th page-turner event with the eight Little Mo Writers Incubator Project participants. That's March 7th, as I mentioned. And there's all kinds of stuff at humanitiesnd.org. I encourage everybody to go up there and look at it. Sue, thanks for being with us today.
All right. Thank you, Doug.
Sue Skaliski is Program Coordinator for Humanities ND. Coming up on Main Street, Postcards from the Prairie.
Writing a will is the best way to protect the people you care about and get peace of mind for the future. To help you get started, Prairie Public has partnered with Free Will to provide this free will writing tool for our audience members in all 50 states. Go to prairiepublic.org/freewill.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
On Europe's new wild, along the iconic Danube River, scientists are helping reintroduce endangered birds to their natural habitat.
I would have never believed that there is the possibility to bond with an animal like that.
Watch Europe's New Wild tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street on Prairie Public. Writing was the theme of our Humanities North Dakota discussion, and next, we'll hear from a creative voice in our neighborhood. Eliza Blue is a singer, songwriter, and author who moved to a South Dakota ranch years ago. She also performs and writes about her transformation from city life to the wide open spaces in an online publication she calls Postcards from the Prairie.
I sit down to write with a nubby Afghan draped around my shoulders. The deep cold of last week's polar vortex has passed. The nights of worrying about double-digit negative temperatures over, hopefully, for a while. Other than a few chickens with frostbitten combs, all the creatures under our care came through the dangerous cold unharmed. And when the temperature climbed out of negative numbers for the first time in a week, it felt momentarily like spring. Until, ensconced in my chilly writing closet, an ancient space heater roaring at full blast, I remembered 10-plus degrees is still very, very cold. Spring in western Dakota is a long way off. The temperature is not the only reason I feel chilled. It's Ash Wednesday, the first day of Lent in the Christian tradition, and it's also the 20th anniversary of my father's sudden death. Living and working in New York City, attempting my first foray into adulthood, the call came at dawn. My mother's weeping voice breaking the news. I flew home for the funeral, but the ground was too frozen to bury him. What will they do with his body? I asked. No one knew for sure. It was the beginning of a Lent that would last for years. A decade later, I found myself in South Dakota. Avenues swirling with human activity replaced by wind-soaked grass and the slow dance of ruminants grazing. I tell people who incredulously ask how I've ended up here that of all the places I've lived, Manhattan and South Dakota are the most similar. They never believe me, but whether lost in a river of bodies at rush hour or an ocean of grass in late spring, the scale is the same. The magnitude a reminder of my own minuteness. I heard recently that we have become a ritual poor people. Most of our holidays revolve around consumerism rather than connection. the roadmap through grief truncated into cliches that alienate as much as they comfort those who are grieving. Sometimes it seems we've forgotten that the journey through the valley of the shadow of death does not follow a straight or clear path. It is a wilderness. This winter feels more like Lent than usual. It's already been a year of ashes. But traditions like Lent offer an opportunity to practice walking through the wilderness while in community. We don't have to do it alone. When Lent ends, there will be a celebration of rebirth, of resurrection, of spring and new life. But for now, it's okay to recognize that darkness still encircles us, that the earth still slumbers frozen beneath our feet, that the seeds are stirring but have not yet sprung forth. For now, it's okay to dwell in the gathering twilight of early evening and remember, from ashes we are born and to ashes we shall return. It will be spring soon, but it's not spring yet. In less than a month, we begin calving. Acting as midwife for livestock is a grueling round-the-clock job. It is the time of birth, new life, exuberance, and exhaustion, but it is also a time of death. Whether it's because of birth defects or troubles during labor, some of the babies born don't live long. They become part of whatever grows next. The blades of grass that feed the other lambs and calves, the leaves of the towering ash trees, the thicket of brush where a doe hides her fawn. I shrug off the Afghan. The wind's picked up, and it's rattling the panes of the south-facing windows. It's a Chinook wind. The weather's changing again. By week's end, my kids will run across the yard in sweaters. It will be too cold to leave off coats, but I'll let them anyway, so they can remember how it feels to move unencumbered by layers of heavy polyester and wood. And when they return to the house later, red-cheeked and shouting, telling me they are cold, too cold, but laughing as they say it, I will smile, lift them into the warmth of my arms, and remember how it feels to run unencumbered, too.
You can follow Eliza Blue and her postcards at elizablue.net. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hi, I'm Tom Brousseau. March along to some different beats on the next Great American Folk Show. His music is old school soul, but with a contemporary power, you're going to love Quinn DeVoe. Enjoy some old-timey string music from Clinton Davis.
Curly-headed woman was the cause of it all. Tell me how long.
Feel the familial warmth of mother-daughter duo Nina and Teresa Ricci.
All the crown jewels in nine glass loop will magnify the light, and I can't wait till I get the glitter in
the
my
sultry,
eye.
Jazzy blues of Sarah Moreau.
Nothing but blue sky.
Plus, singer-songwriter and author Michael Patrick F. Smith sings and reads from his debut book, The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown.
I can drive a truck, swing a sledgehammer, I got two good hands I'm gonna put on to you.
On the Great American Folk Show, Sunday, March 7th at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 24th. North Dakota has no shortage of famous sons and daughters, but most North Dakotans largely remain unknown for their contributions to the state. Dr. John Grieg is one such anonymous citizen. On this date in 1905, residents of Botno learned that Dr. Grieg had passed away at his home in Yakima, Washington. He had been in poor health. The local newspaper observed, "Though we expected his death, the news of it brings fresh to our minds a deep sorrow for one well-beloved for those who knew him best and much respected by all." John Grieg was born in Middlesex, Ontario, in 1851. He graduated from Toronto Normal School at the age of 16 and began teaching, but went on to graduate from the Manitoba Medical College in 1886. Grieg first visited Botno in Dakota Territory in 1883. He moved there in 1887. His medical practice became the largest in the county. He purchased a farm and brought his parents to live there. He cultivated half of his land. The other half was valuable for timber. In addition to medicine and farming, Grieg was also active in local affairs. He was instrumental in organizing the town's Baptist church. He served on the County Board of Health. He was especially interested in education. He served 3 terms as superintendent of Botno County Schools. Grieg was also active in the Democratic Party and served on both county and state party committees. In 1895, Grieg married Mary McBride, a Canadian schoolteacher. Mary died 3 years later, leaving Grieg with 2 sons. The younger boy died at the age of 2. This took a great deal out of the doctor, and by 1902, it was apparent his health was also failing. He moved to Washington with his mother and sister. When his mother died, he brought her remains back to Botno for burial. His friends were shocked when they saw him. They described him as a broken man. Only in his mid-50s, he died shortly after returning to Yakima. In every age, it's up to ordinary people to achieve progress. Dr. Grieg is an example of an ordinary person whose contributions did not make it into the history books. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
President Biden signed an executive order that allows transgender people to serve in the armed forces.
I had an Army recruiter message me, and then a Marine recruiter followed. I take it to mean, like, now I'm being seen.
But it's not quite a reality as a policy yet.
What we're really telling people is, get ready.
Why eager transgender recruits need to hold off a while longer. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream online at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, we'll hear Diana D'Amico-Polowitz. She's the author of Blaming Teachers, Professionalization Policies, and the Failure of Reform in American History. She was a guest on the Prairie Pulse television show. Madeline will review another new movie, Judas and the Black Messiah. And Sue Balcom will drop by for Main Street Eats to talk about vegetable jerky. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.